As we're journeying through the Gospel of Luke, I want to remind you again kind of this setting this morning. We've got Luke writing to Theophilus, and he's talking about Jesus in Luke 6. He's writing this, speaking on the Sermon on the Plain. It's a flat area with a bunch of people that gathered around. And we talked last week, we're told that Jesus did something interesting. He was teaching his disciples. It said that he was speaking to them. He was teaching his disciples what it meant to follow him and be like God in the midst of a great multitude. And I likened it last week to after baseball games as a coach when I would sit on a bucket and talk to my team, the parents and other players and other teams would get to listen in. That's kind of what's happening here. Jesus is instructing his disciples what it means to be a follower of him and defining for them what kingdom living looks like. What does it look like to be a follower of Jesus in that first century? I want to set that up for you just a little bit this morning. Who it is that Jesus is talking to? It's a ragtag bunch of men and women that end up following Jesus. You've got some folks in this room that are zealots, and zealots' desires to overthrow the Roman government. You've got some folks who are looking for a political coup. They want a political messiah and wants to rescue them. You've got a guy who was a tax collector who got probably fairly wealthy by overtaxing his fellow Israelites. Probably hated by quite a few Israelites who he made enemies with by overcharging them so he and his family could have a pretty good living. You had some people with some great aspirations. You know, James and John want to sit on the right hand of Jesus, right, left hand, and he comes into his kingdom. They don't really know what they're asking for. You've got some anonymous people here who just kind of slip through the gospel and you know their name, but not a lot else about them. You've got these men who in just a few short years will only give their lives for following this Jesus. And you've got Jesus who's teaching them now about halfway through his ministry what it looks like to follow him. And it's hard to grasp. I think these guys are going to see things, Jesus do things that no one has ever done. They've never seen it happen. Like the Old Testament prophets, maybe there was some healing and some demons cast out and maybe some resurrection, but it certainly wasn't the norm. And you've got Jesus, he's healing the sick and casting out demons and raising the dead back to life. And he's teaching them this new, refreshing, authoritative way. The disciples are like, I don't know what's going on. We don't know where else to go. We believe that you're God, but that's about all we've settled on. And so I find a lot of comfort in that, right? I think as I read through the scriptures, oftentimes I want to align myself with the hero of the story, right? I want to align myself. When we're talking about David and Goliath, I want to be David. Right? When we're talking about Saul conquering, I'd like to be Saul. Samson, I want to be Samson before he gets his haircut, obviously. I'd like to be all the guys who are doing it right. Right? And I even would like to be like Jesus when I read through the Gospels. Until I see that Jesus is misunderstood. Until I see that Jesus is betrayed by his closest friends. Until I see that Jesus is abandoned. So I see that Jesus is persecuted and ultimately murdered. I don't know that I want to be like that Jesus, if I'm being completely honest. I mean, something really deep down in me wants to be. That's not my nature at all, right? That's not my nature. My nature is like, I want the Jesus that the multitudes love. I want the ones that, I want to be like Jesus when the multitudes are amazed and the disciples are like, oh, that was really cool. And that's not the call. We're called to follow Jesus when we did it and when we don't. To be popular, to be not popular. Jesus set us up last week talking about how, listen, if you're really following me, no matter what culture you live in, whether it's first century Israel or whether it's here now in central Illinois, there's going to be people that are going to love you, there's going to be people that completely misunderstand you and hate you because they hated the prophets before you and they killed them. So when you live in a prophetic way, when you live in a way, and when I say that, what I mean by that is that we live in a way that is an example of the redeeming grace of God. Our life's an invitation to people like, hey, you can be changed. You can find hope. You can choose to live differently because of that. It's convicting and it's not always embraced. So I want you to ask yourself a question this morning. Who are your enemies? Who are not our enemies? Who's your enemy? You got two or three names yet picked out? Anybody? I'd like you to announce them. No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. But enemies are hard. Like when Jesus is teaching on the Sermon on the Plain, when when Jesus begins here to teach them about what life is like when people don't like you, they're like, well, the Romans don't like us. And they show it pretty much every day. They oppress us, we're marginalized. But it's harder for us to get our head around that. I mean, I think it's a real obscure, not personal way we can go, I mean, there's some countries in the Middle East that probably are enemies. They don't like us. I mean, there's Russia and China on some fronts, whether it's economic, political. You then go, okay, sorry, they are enemies. But do you feel a weight of that? Other than maybe being, well, a good word my mom would use, perturbed. It's a great word. I haven't used that in years. I don't know if I've ever used it, but I'm going to be like, I'm older now. I'm going to use things like perturbed and cattywampus. So, so I know what it means. We're trailing off, so back to it, kids. You guys are people who irritate us. Politically, economically, socially, right? But enemies? So let's even go a little step. Like, you know anybody that doesn't like you? I'm asking you a question. You know anybody that doesn't like you? It doesn't just like you, but actively doesn't like you.
Yeah.
Right? Yes! Right? You said it loudly. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. So there are people that we know don't want our best. They actually like it if you fail. Right? They love it if some bad things happen to you. And some people you can name, some people you can't go, I think I know who they are. How about some people that you just don't really care for? Anything like that? You just rather not spend some time around? Right? I'm not that, like, sometimes it's our spouse, I get that. But I'm talking about long term. You really just don't want to be around, you don't want to spend time with them. How many of you have ever heard the phrase, like, the EGR people in your lives? EGR, has anybody ever heard of that? The extra grace required people, right? Yeah. So you've got some folks like that. I mean, you probably can all meet that person. So think those two or three people that you can think of. They're not necessarily people just irritating you. Maybe you've got a short fuse, or maybe you're having a bad day. But who are people that genuinely don't like you and would like to see some bad things happen to you? Can you think of some of those people? I want you to think about those for the next few minutes, because Jesus is about to teach his disciples about what kingdom living looks like in a world where not everybody likes you, not everybody thinks like you, not everybody agrees with you. And it's easy for us to kind of find ourselves isolated into a Christian bubble in the same theological streams, but we disagree on such minor things that we laugh about it. But you and I know that in the real world, that we step outside and we can have some very different opinions that can cause some real conflict. And it can even escalate to the point of violence and death, depending on what we're actually disagreeing about and how we do it. One of the saddest things that I think is that you have a generation or more of people who've been trained up that says, here's what you don't talk about at dinner parties. You don't talk about politics, religion, at a dinner party. And I saw something online, one of the few things you see online that are actually positive, that I think actually makes sense. It says it's not that we shouldn't teach our kids, or we should tell our kids, don't speak about politics and religion. Those are the things you don't talk about. It's that we should teach them how to talk about them in a respectful manner, and how to get to some sort of agree to disagree, to be able to hash out and debate in a civil manner. Civility is quickly fleeting in our culture. So Jesus is talking about, what do you do in a culture where civility is gone, where the Romans want to kill you, they're only going to take advantage of you, and you're going to be, by definition, as a follower of Jesus, you're going to be marginalized, and you're going to be outcast, and you're probably going to be persecuted. He's speaking to men and women who are not in a, in just kind of a figurative way, going to be persecuted. It's not that, like, oh, my neighbors aren't going to want to come to our dinner parties anymore, and they're not going to hang out with us when we find out we follow Jesus. At least there's a man in this group of people who's going to be quartered in the next few years of his life. There's a guy who's going to get boiled in oil and sent to an island to live the rest of his life in exile. There's a guy who's going to be thrown off of the temple and killed and beaten to death with the heavy scrolls of the Old Testament. There's a man in this group who's going to be crucified in a few years upside down. So Jesus is talking in a very tangible way how to live in an upside down world and in a marginalized. How do you react to that? So let's take a look at the text this morning in Luke chapter 6. But I say to you, who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those that hate you. Bless those that curse you. And pray for those that abuse you. I'll leave this up for a minute. But I say to you who hear. So Jesus is talking to his disciples, and now he's going, hey, anybody that can hear me, anybody in this crowd, here's what I want you to do. I want you to love your enemies. They know who their enemies are, their own. want you to do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those that abuse you. Jesus is saying there's a new kingdom here, and we're going to exchange love for hate. We're going to give blessing for cursing. And we're going to give prayer for abuse. Jesus is calling people in a very real way, not just hypothetically, to pray for those. One of the things that made my skin crawl a little bit is when and I'm not saying this, and you've probably been guilty of this, I know that I've probably done the same thing myself, but it just makes me cringe as of late when someone will ask for prayer or something online, whether it's, whatever, it's on Facebook, Twitter, whatever, and people just go, prayers, fill that prayer, percent, prayer, whatever, and are you really, who am I to judge? I'm certainly not judging you, or I'm silently judging you. I'm guessing people are now praying, we go, we just type out prayer, and we're done. It's like, thank you. And Jesus is saying, I want you to pray for those who abuse you. Those who have taken advantage of you. I want you to pray for them. You know how hard, I know that you know how hard it is. I know that you in this room have been hurt. You've been hurt by people that you should have, that you've trusted. That trust has been betrayed, you've been hurt. You've commanded to pray for them. You've been hurt by people inside the church. Jesus, pray for those people who intentionally hurt you. You've been hurt by people that call themselves your friends, and Jesus says you should pray for them. It's really hard to hate somebody that you're praying for long term. Like, you can pray for them today, and hey, I'll still be there. Bitterness might still be there. But if you pray for them tomorrow, the day after that, the day after that, and you begin to ask God to change their heart and to forgive them and to have mercy on them, it's hard for you to hold it. Harder for you to hold a grudge. So we're going to love those that hate us. We're going to bless those who curse us. Whatever they give, we give back something beautiful. They're redeeming. It's hard. By the way, Jesus didn't say, I'm not going to teach you something easy. So you want to know what it's like to be a follower of Jesus? Here's what we do. We love, we bless, we pray. Well then, look at what he goes on to say here. Give some examples. He says, to the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. Now, a lot of times, I think we've talked a little bit about this and had some conversations this week. Is this like, okay, when someone pops you in a cheek, you go, bam, good one, here's this one. Is that what we're talking about? Or is it more of a first century kind of colloquialism where it almost be like, it'd be equivalent to maybe someone spitted in someone's face today? And if someone would come up to you and they were going to say something bad about you, or they were going to try to belittle you in public, they would just slap you. He says, if you can slap like that, don't defend yourself. Like, don't rise up and go, hey, you can't do that to me. You can't hurt my pride. You can't. Is that what we're talking about? Or here's a question that I have. It's important that we kind of get to the root of that teaching. What does Jesus say? But here's what I would say is the bigger issue. Does it matter? I mean, big picture, right? We're kind of getting at the same thing. So what I want you to do is I want you to see the overarching principle of this text and not try to go, okay, so if somebody punches me, should I offer them the other cheek? Well, first of all, get out of there, right? And then just maybe say, you didn't get the sign or something. I'm not expecting you to stay there to be pumped. However, one who strikes you on the cheek, offer them the other also. And the one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. That means if someone steals your jacket, give them your shirt. How many of you have seen, I don't know, I feel like that this is just a running theme for Luke, kind of somehow seen in parallel. I know I've mentioned this several times, is Les Miserables. And if you've seen Les Miserables, and if you haven't, I'm going to recap it for you again, probably every week until everyone's seen it. So there's a guy by the name of Jean Valjean, and he's in prison. He's in prison because his family is starving. And Paris, French Revolution era, and he's starving, and he steals some bread for his family. And he gets arrested for it, goes to jail. And he's released, has to go to Paris for parole, and check in with an officer. And while he's there, he's sleeping on a park bench. And this old woman says, what are you doing out here on the park bench? And he's like, I couldn't find a place to stay. She's like, if you knocked on all the doors, he's like, I knocked on every door. She's like, you knocked on every door. He's like, why do you say that? Because if you knocked on that door, you'd have a place to stay. And the bishop opens the door, and he knocks on the bishop, opens up the door, and lets him in. He comes in and has dinner with him that night. He's talking telling his life story, and the priest is gracious, loving, and lends him a listening ear. And that night, Jean Valjean goes to bed, and he wakes up in the middle of the night. And while they're eating, he saw that there was really some valuable silver in the house. And so he wakes up in the middle of the night, grabs a bat, and starts to steal all of the silver. Bishop catches him, punches him, and leaves. Out the door he goes. Police catch him. And they catch him, and they say, "You've got an awful lot of silver here. We recognize where that's from. It's from the bishop. And we should probably take it back to him." He says, "No, he gave it to me." So he lies to the officer. He's like, No. He said I could have it. Like, sure. So he brings him back to the bishop's home, and he tells the bishop the story. He says, "Hey, we caught this guy. He was getting out of town, and he had all your silver." And the priest stands in his face. He says, "Jean Valjean, I'm very disappointed in you." He says, "I told you, do not forget the candlesticks." So he goes and he grabs his two silver candlesticks, and he puts them in the bag. And he's like, "This guy, he was telling the truth." And he's like, "Yeah, he's fine. So the police leave. And Jean Valjean says, "Why in the world would you do that? You had me. They were going to send me back to prison. Why would you do that? I was stealing from you. I was violent to you. I took advantage of your grace. I took advantage of your mercy. Why in the world would you do that?" He says, "Jean Valjean, with this silver, I have purchased your soul and given it back to God." And what act of mercy transformed this guy's life? And when we read from this text here, Luke 6, I can't help but get a little bit of that. If we can go back the previous slide, look at at the end of verse where he says, "And from the one who takes away from you, takes away your cloak, don't withhold your tunic either. Hey, from the guy who steals all your silver, don't withhold your candlesticks." That's what he's saying. How hard is that? If somebody were to steal from you your lawnmower, would you give them your can of gas? Hey, don't forget this. Right? If somebody were to take your car, would you go, "Hey, don't forget the car cover. I like to keep it clean." He's going beyond. It's amazing to say if someone took your coat. Look what he goes on to say in regard to when someone steals from you. He says, "Give to everyone who begs from you. And from one who takes away your goods, don't demand them back." So if somebody steals from you, don't go, "Hey, give that back to me." Remember that, brothers and sisters? Right? Remember that, kids? Don't fight over your stuff. "Give to everyone who begs from you." Everyone, Jesus? Have you not walked in a big city, Jesus? Have you not seen how many people there are who ask? How many of you, I want you to just read one, I'll finish this in 31. He says, "And as you wish others would do to you, do so to them." He says, "Do unto others as you have them do to you." So, regarding this idea of giving to everyone who asks, so how many of you have ever given to somebody and had it go less than good? Took advantage of you. You found out that they really weren't in need. You gave them, even though the story was skeptical. I have a friend who went to take a turkey to somebody he met one year right on Thanksgiving, and he knocked on the door, knocked on the neighbor's door, and he was met with a gun in his face. He's like, "Well, that's great. Not doing that anymore." I remember one time when I may have told the story here before. Again, being older, so apparently that tells a lot of stories the same. We were in Washington, D.C. group of students. My first trip way out of town, they got a bunch of students. We were in student ministry. We were on the ball out from the Lincoln Monument there for a big concert. We were in D.C. for this huge youth conference. We were there for, I think, 3, 4, 5 days. And it was my first trip out. And I remember telling these students, I was young. I had no idea what I was doing, but I know that I wasn't losing a kid on my watch, right? So I told them, "Hey, no matter what happens, you guys are by my side. You guys stick together. We are like family. Wherever I go, you go. I'm not losing you guys. It is packed here. There's 100,000 people here. Can't lose you guys. You guys stay with me." So at this concert, we're rocking out. We leave, and I'm walking, and I'm talking to everybody. I'm making friends. "How are you? Where are you from?" I turn around, and there is nobody in my group with me. None. They are all gone. So I'm the one that gets lost. So I'm like, "You know what? We're all going to say this is cell phone because I'm a dinosaur, right?" So we're walking to the hotel, and it is a mile, right? We're walking, and I just keep, it took me a while, if I'm going to be honest, before I realized that my group was not with me. We had other adult leaders, so don't think like, if you ever go somewhere, they'll lose your children. But, so we're we're walking and start asking people, hey, where's your hotel? Where are you guys staying? Where are you staying? Like, where the Omni, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, dude, you were going the wrong direction, right? And I'm like, you're kidding me. They're like, no, I'm like, it's over there. So I've got to go upstream, salmon, right? So I'm swimming upstream here, trying to get through this crowd. I get through the crowd, and it is well past midnight at this point. I'm lost in D.C. And there's this old church, a Gothic church. I'm assuming it's an old Catholic or Lutheran church. It's a great, beautiful building. And there's a homeless guy curled up on the steps. And at this point, my feet are tired. I'm lost. I have given up hope. I sit down with this guy. And I'm like, we're going to figure this out together, I guess. So I'm just exhausted. It's a long night. I'm tired. I sit next to the guy. I go, so what's your story? So what's my story? Yeah. So he tells me his life story. And he tells me how he was a lawyer and got involved and had some really heavy addiction. And was married, lost his wife and his kids, lost his career, lost everything with this addiction. And now he's in the streets. And he just told me a story. I said, man, that's awful. He's like, man, you know, can you give me some food? And I'm like, you know what? I'm hungry too. Let's go get something to eat. So we're going to go to McDonald's after midnight in D.C. And we're walking and it is late. And we take a shortcut to an alley, right? And I'm like, I'm the friendliest guy. Hey, this guy's, it's great. We start walking down the alley, and he's behind me. And this looks like a scene from every movie that a guy has ever got jumped in an alley is filmed in this alley. Right? It's got the big industrial garage doors, there's smoke coming out as I remember, right? There were people at the end of the alley walking down. That's what it felt like to me, right? I'm walking down this alley, and I get about half of the alley. And it dawns on me, this is how it ends. And you laugh at that? I was convinced. I'm like, oh, of course, it's how I die. And here's me of such large faith. I was praying this prayer, and I am not joking. God, let him shoot me in the back of the head, because I don't want to see it coming. So brave. So brave. Like, so we get to McDonald's. Right? This guy's probably terrified of me, going, why don't we leave this guy down an alley? I don't know. He's probably going to rob me. We get to the McDonald's and it's closed. And I'm like, of course it's closed, right? And so then at that point, I literally am like, I said, get my hotel, Mr. You know, I said, take my cash. So he points me to the hotel. My kids are safe. He's safe. It's all good. But I say all that to say, and just because it goes wrong once, it doesn't mean that we have an excuse to stop giving, stop being generous. I also want to throw this out there. Just because somebody is poor or broken doesn't mean they're violent. Doesn't mean they're criminal. It doesn't mean that they are broken more than you. It just means that maybe they've made some really bad decisions. Your life has been really hard. Right? But one or two bad experiences, and we start to go, that's it. I tried this helping thing. I tried this generosity thing. Try to live open-handed, and I'm not going to do it. And here's what happens. When Jesus says, give to everybody who begs of you, we hear everybody, and we go, well, Jesus certainly couldn't have meant that. And so as Christians, we use it as a license to give to really hardly anybody. Right? Because we get super discerning. And I think there is a responsibility on our behalf to do due diligence and not just waste the resources that God has given us. But at some point in my life, I have to go, I'm responsible to live open-handed and generous, and they're responsible to do whatever they do with life, whatever I give. So did Jesus mean to give to everybody who begs of you? If he didn't, he should have said, give to some of the people who begs of you. Now remember, begging looks probably a little different than it did in Jesus' day than ours, but I don't know that gives us an excuse to not at least sit and have the conversation. How many of you, when you're walking in Chicago, going to dinner, tell your spouse, your friends, or your kids, don't make eye contact? Right? Somebody on the street. Right? I've had some of the best conversations in Chicago with men and women that are sitting on the street, homeless, that are on Lower Level Drive, and are really just down and up. And some of them likely have taken advantage of me. And I just think of all the times that I've worked in the system trying to take advantage of God's grace, and he doesn't keep business like he doesn't keep it. He doesn't stop giving it to me. So, turn the cheek, give your shirt, give to everyone that begs, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. Brothers and sisters, I want to encourage you that if we know nobody in our lives who are in need of anything, we probably have too small of someone. Right? We love those who are marginalized, those who are broken, and those who are hurting, those who are down and loving. If I don't know somebody who needs a coat or needs a shirt or is asking for help, then I probably have turned a blind eye to those who are broken and hurting and marginalized and that don't have a voice in our culture. So, Jesus is talking about people who are going to take advantage of us, who hate us, who are going to take advantage of our grace. Why would anybody do that? How should we respond? Look at what Jesus says about this very thing, about like who we give and how we love and how we serve. He says, well, if you love those that love you, what benefit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. He's like, come on, that's easy. You do good to those who do good to you. What benefit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to give back the same amount. But love your enemies. So after he says, listen, it's easy to love those that love you. To be like me is to love those that don't love you. It's easy to do good to those that are going to do good to you. If you're going to be like me, you've got to do good to those that are looking to hurt you. And then he says, if you lend to people because you know they're going to give it back, if you only take those people out to lunch and pay for their lunch because you know that ultimately they're going to pay for your lunch back, anybody does that. To go and just be generous, that's a different kind of person in this world. He says, but in spite of all that, love your enemies. Do good and lend. Expect nothing in return. And your reward will be great. Why will your reward be great? Just by loving, by doing good and expecting nothing in return? You'll be sons of the Most High. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Now what I want to do here is to remind you that it is my tendency and your tendency to read ourselves as the hero in every stinking story. We are the ungrateful. We are the broken. We are the sinners. We are the one who offend the holy God. And when he says, we want to go, oh, we're the good who's just dispensing good and loving and kindness and it's us, the good people. And he says, well, that might be true. You might be good. You might be not. Because of my grace that's worked in you. But don't forget, as it pertains to our relationship with God, we are the ungrateful. We are the evil. And God is gracious to us. He has loved us. He has done us good. And he has given to us, knowing that we. This is what the Father is like. And so when you and I love and give and expect nothing in return, because that's the way the Father is, we're starting to become like Jesus when it comes to that. Does that make sense? I want to remind you of a story. There's a story about a guy, he's a businessman, and he owes a guy a bazillion dollars. That's a real term. A ton of money. His business goes through a hard fourth quarter loss and they can't pay it back. So he goes with one of the directors and sees if they can sell off on their assets and they can't. So he goes to the guy that he owes his $5 billion to and says, I can't pay it back. And the company they owe all this money to says, you know what, it's fine. It's fine, I love you. We've got plenty of money here. We're doing okay with all our other subsidiaries. So you know what, it's forgiven. I don't need it. Want you to keep going, so your debt's forgiven. The guy's like, that's awesome. And as he's walking out the door, he's going to get his car checked by the valet, waiting for his car to get pulled up. A guy shows up that owes him $5 from lunch last week, and he says, hey, I need my money. The guy's like, I don't have the money. He's like, you know what, then you're going to jail. But he calls out and arrested. He's thrown into jail. He says, you're not getting out of jail until you're getting every last penny. And as he's waiting for his car, the guy that just forgave him $5 billion comes down and stands on the curb and says, dude, are you kidding me? I just forgave a $5 billion debt, and you want to throw that guy in jail for $5? You are now going to go in, and you are not getting out until you pay back every last cent. It's Matthew 18. It's a Matthew 18 story that Jesus talks about a guy who owes somebody a ton of money and can't repay him, and he's forgiven. And then he's so hard, so ugly to those that can't repay him. And so I just want to suggest to you that when we live with tight fists and our hearts aren't open and generous, I'm not just talking about our money. I'm not. I'm talking about time. I'm talking about our love. I'm talking about our mercy. I'm talking about our forgiveness. When we withhold that from people, that tells me that we don't really realize deep down in our soul how much Christ has forgiven us. Because if we realize how much we've offended God and how much of a debt we could not pay to God and how much grace God has given us and how great of a judgment we have escaped, and then we hold others accountable for things that are far less in comparison, we don't understand the grace of God. Those who've been forgiven much will love much. The problem is we just don't forgive how much. We don't realize how much we've been forgiven, so we love little. You notice how offensive our sin is to a holy, perfect, and righteous God? Yet he loves you and has forgiven you and has restored you, redeemed you, and given you blessing and blessing on top of blessing on top of blessing, and you're not going to talk to someone because what? They ripped your shirt, they took your book, they said something about your mama. Like, I don't know what it was, right? And in comparison to what God has forgiven us, and I'm not suggesting that this work of reconciliation is easy, but I'm suggesting that if the reconciliation that the Father gave us through Jesus on the cross was certainly not. And it's certainly not without the reach, because of the grace of God, for you and I to reconcile with those that we have been hurt by. So I want to end with this, because I'm sure at this point in the service, I have convinced every one of you, beyond a doubt, that you're going to love your enemies this week. Right? At least you'll try to. Right? Or at least until noon. That's my guess. Because it's hard. So Charlie, listen, I want to love my enemies. Jesus said, listen, to all those people who can hear me, I want you to love your enemies. You might want to do that. What does that look like? Well, I want to take you, friends, to a Saturday night somewhere in your past. And there's probably a time when you got all, I'm going to use another one of my mom's fancy words, gussied up, and you slicked the hair back, and you put the makeup on, you got your dancing shoes out, you got dressed to the nines, stood in front of the mirror, you did everything all right, you wouldn't watch two people stand in front of a pastor and make a commitment spend the rest of their lives together. And it's likely on one of those occasions that you spent a sweltering June afternoon in a packed church, that you heard a familiar passage at weddings, also made famous by plates, t-shirts, and banners that hang above people's door, about love. And as you hear it, everybody's like, oh, as these two people are looking lovingly into each other's eyes, and they hear what love is like, and people in the church are going, they got that love. Oh, God. 6 months later, one of them's ducking from something getting thrown, somebody's sleeping on a couch. Like, it's all, 1 Corinthians 13 is all warm and cuddly on the wedding day. It's hard when you're fighting with your spouse about something. It's really hard. It's really, really, really hard when someone doesn't like. Somebody wants bad for you. When somebody would love it if bad things would happen to you, and they make it known that they don't care for you at all, and Jesus says, I want you to love them. Now, I want you to think about those people, and I want you to listen to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13 as he defines love for us. So get a picture of that person. That person. May not be an enemy, but they don't like you, and the feeling is pretty much mutual. Okay? Jesus, here's how I want you to treat them. Look at what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Oh, come on. Put out of your gate. Love is patient. Love is kind. Kind. It doesn't envy or boast. So when that person that hates you and life goes well for them, you're supposed to have a bigger house, bigger car, nicer this, bigger that. Yeah, of course. Doesn't envy. Doesn't boast. It's not arrogant or rude. I know that hit home somewhere. Anybody? I'm not calling any names. It's not arrogant or rude. It doesn't insist on its own way. I just want to point out, that is hard to do with friends. Right? Much less with somebody that doesn't like you there, because this is my way or the highway, dude. Especially when God places you in a position of power over your enemies. When you're in a place of influence or a place of power, and you've got it in your power to do something just to twist the knife. Don't forget, there was a guy named King Saul who wanted to kill David. Wanted to kill him. David's hiding in a cave, and King Saul comes in, and David has him. He's got a knife in his hand. He sneaks up everywhere behind him. He takes Saul by the robe. He lifts up the knife, and he cuts the end of the robe off and sneaks back into the shadow. And then when Saul leaves, he holds it up. Hey, look at this. Could have killed you. What are you going to do to your enemy? What are you going to do to that person that doesn't like you and maybe you don't care for them? What are you going to do when God places you in a position that you can hurt them? Are you going to use it? You're going to pay that baby. You're going to use it as an example to show the love of Jesus and when you should have. When grace doesn't make sense and you're like, why are you nice to me? It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable and resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing. It's not glad when something bad happens or when you do something bad to them. It doesn't rejoice in that. But it rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things. Put up with it, man. It believes all things. It means I believe this person can be changed. I believe that by the grace of Jesus, I can be reconciled. It hopes all things. Hopes all things. Like, I hope the best for you. I wish the best for you, my enemy. It endures all things. Love never ends. So when do you need to stop loving your enemy? Never. Ever. Right? So I know that we want vengeance. I know that we want justice. Oh, justice on our enemies. Right? Remember, the Lord says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, and I will repay. See, when we act out and we get our own vengeance, and we get payback, and we twist that knife, here's what we're believing about God in that moment. What we're believing about God in that moment is that God isn't just, and that God isn't going to take care of this, and God doesn't know what happened, and God isn't powerful enough to take care of it, and we're going to take care of it, because deep down in the recesses of our soul, what we don't want to talk about it, is that we believe that God is going to show this person grace, and we don't want them to get grace. At least get me one good punching before you forgive God. Right? If we're really going to be honest about that, it's hard to love. I want to encourage you to read 1 Corinthians 13 this week. And I want you to think about it in light of your enemies. I want you to think about it in light of your spouse when you're not just married, but when you're doing life and it's not always easy. I want you to think about what 1 Corinthians 13 looks like. It's not just something to hang above your doorway. It's something to be fleshed out in a hurting and broken world that doesn't see the value of following Jesus. That isn't going to lift you up and praise you and pat you on the back because you want to be a follower of Jesus. And if you live like that, your life will not make sense to most of the When God has delivered your enemy into your hand and you forgive him and you show him grace and you reflect the grace of God that he has given you, you're going to leverage that opportunity to give him the opportunity to share the gospel. When somebody says, why didn't you repay me? You're going to go, because God has forgiven me of way more than I'll ever have to forgive you of. And he'll forgive you of way more than you could ever imagine. It gives you an opportunity to share the gospel, leaving your enemy. I'll just end with this very last story. There's a guy by the name of Brother Andrew, and he was called God's Smuggler. If you haven't read that book, it's a great book, God's Smuggler. He used to smuggle scripture into the underground church in places where it was absolutely closed to the gospel. And he was talking to, I believe, you may want to read that book just to check my facts, but I believe he was in Poland. And he was reaching and ministering to the underground church in Poland some years ago. And they said that they wondered why God allowed them to live under, I think at the time it was Russian occupation. Why would he allow this to happen? Why would he allow our enemies to conquer us? And he said, here's what Brother Andrew told me. He said, because God has sent you on a mission to love your enemies. Because you didn't go and love your enemies, God has brought them to you so you can love them under the weight of oppression. And so maybe some of the enemies in our life were brought into our life by God so that we can be an example of them to the grace of Because we wouldn't go to them naturally. Maybe God has brought some conflict into our life so that you and I can be an example. Number one, God will use the conflict to shape us and make us more like Jesus. And number two, maybe he's brought them so that we can show them grace, so that we can point them to the ultimate grace of God forgiving their sins. So I hope that you'll take advantage of this. I hope that you'll live like Jesus and that you'll follow him and that you'll love your enemies. There's no excuse that not how. I think the first thing is pretty clear. I think Luke 6 is pretty clear. The fact is, it's just not easy. We don't want to do that most of the time. And you and I have a decision to make today about who we live in obedience to Jesus. So, it's my prayer for you this week that you don't have to test this. I hope you have no enemies that you have conflict with this week. I pray that God is going to give you grace in all those relationships. But should you find yourself on the wrong end of conflict this week, I pray that you'll be a grace giver rather than someone who seeks revenge. The end of the day is just ending. So, let me pray for us this morning. Father, I just want to say thank you. Thank you to God, you have forgiven us of a great debt. And I'm not even sure that we'll ever get our head around it. How deeply indebted God, we were to you. Dead in our sins, without hope. But God, because of your great love and your great mercy, that even when we were your enemies, when we were enemies of the cross by the way we live, God, you showed your love for us in this. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God, we didn't bring anything to the table. We were opposed to you. And even if we thought that we were living, that you just loved everybody, there's no need for us to repent or to make a commitment to Christ, even if we weren't aware of that, God, we were just trying to be a quote-unquote good person, God, that makes us an enemy of the cross because we didn't recognize that the cross was the only way to know you. We were working against that. God, I'm thankful for your grace and just simply how amazing it is. And God, I pray that you would help us get our head around how much you have forgiven us so that we'll be quick to forgive others. Father, thank you for your mercy. May we be mercy givers this week. In Jesus' name.